I'm Kelly Gardner and welcome to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in the 2017 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference in Melbourne. Today we're talking about historical crime fiction and two of our favourite amateur detectives. But first, our guests. Robert Gott was born in Queensland and lives in Melbourne. He has published many books for children and is also the creator of the hilarious newspaper cartoon The Adventures of Naked Man. He's the author of historical crime novels The Holiday Murders and its sequel The Port Fairy Murders, and the William Power series set in 1940s Australia, The Serpent's Sting, Good Murder, A Thing of Blood, and Amongst the Dead. Solari Gentile was born in Sri Lanka, grew up in Brisbane, and now lives in the Snowy Mountains. She studied astrophysics, switched to law, and after years as a lawyer, decided to write stories instead. She's the author of the Roland Sinclair Mysteries, which began with A Few Right-Thinking Men, all set in 1930s Sydney. She has also written the Hero Trilogy, set during the time of the Iliad. Solari and Robert are appearing together in September as part of a conference all about historical fiction presented by the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. We've brought them together today to give us a taste of their conference panel, Historical Whodunits, Solving Crimes Across the Centuries. Welcome, Solari and Robert. Let's talk about murder. What is it, do you think, about historical mysteries that make them so incredibly popular? Solari, let's start with you.
Oh, look, I think there's two facets to that. One is murder is always going to be popular because it adds that mix of thrill and engagement and that ability to experience danger from the comfort of your armchair to every story. But the other thing that historical murder in particular allows us to do is to actually look back at a period in time and perhaps through that period, look at our own world through that safe lens of distance and time.
And what is extraordinary is that nothing has changed.
Except a few forensic...
Except a few forensic techniques and some technology, but the politics, the morals, the ethics, they remain the same.
There seems to be this repeated pattern that comes up over and over again.
Depressingly, yeah.
So is that part of what makes them so popular, Robert?
I think one of the reasons people like crime fiction is crime fiction offers solutions. Historical crime fiction is really crime fiction with, you know, costumes, I guess.
Costumes. And certain inflections in speech.
Certain inflections in speech, yeah. But I think people like crime fiction because most of us live very safe, comfortable lives. And I think people who live traumatic lives probably don't like reading crime fiction. People who live lives, like we do, if I lived the kind of life that the characters in my novel lived, I would not want to read about that at all.
So is it about...
too busy solving crimes, anyway.
Or getting beaten up.
Yes, exactly.
It's about the fascination of the other? Is that also about it being in the past?
And also the familiarity, though. I think one of the things that historical crime fiction does particularly well is it brings out the familiar, but allows us to view it as outsiders, as if we're not a part of it. So we can look at, for example, my period is the 1930s, which is very similar to the era that we're going through now with the rise in totalitarianism and populism. And we can look back at the 30s and we know what it resulted in. It resulted in World War II. And we can see the familiarity of that pattern, but we can actually abstract ourselves from being in the middle of it and be partisan about it and take that sort of extended view or that distant view that allows us to think about it, I think, with a little bit better clarity.
Yeah, I agree that the familiarity thing is really important. My books are set in the 40s, and like Solari, I think that they're sufficiently distant to appear nostalgic. in a way, but sufficiently close to be familiar, paradoxically, to be familiar. It's a different thing when you're reading the Hilary Mantel, say, book set in Tudor England. That seems to me to be a completely alien world and fascinating, therefore, yes, but for different reasons.
So the near past, in a way, yes, is almost like a distinctive subset of historical fiction. And one of the things, I mean, people often ask why readers are attracted to historical crime fiction, but one of the reasons writers are attracted to historical crime fiction is it allows us to say what we need to say and make a commentary on our lives now without it being a polemic.
That's true.
So let's talk a little bit about Rowley and Will.
Mm-hmm.
Robert, where did the idea, where did the story of William Power come from? Where did it start for you?
It started with wanting to have written a novel rather than to write a novel. But there was only one way around that, and that was to sit down and write it. And
damn it! Don't you hate that?
I know. Growing up in Queensland, in Maryborough, I grew up with a story that always fascinated me about something that happened in 1942. And it was the story of a woman who went missing. She was missing for about 4 or 5 weeks. She was 21 years old. And her body was found floating, dissolving, in fact, in the town's water supply, which meant that everyone in Maryborough was drinking her and putting her in their tea and bathing with her and washing their hair and doing their teeth. And I thought as a child that was just completely fabulous, especially as my parents.
And there you have, folks, the insight into the historical crime fiction writer.
So that was the story that I wanted to start with. And I used that as the basis for my first novel. And because I'm reasonably lazy, when I say reasonably, I suppose I mean extremely, I didn't want to write a crime novel that required me to know stuff like forensics. Because now, after CSI and all of those shows, if you get the timing of the maggot that forms on a corpse wrong, you get letters.
Everyone's an expert.
Everyone's an expert. You'll get letters saying, I think you'll find that the coffin beetle doesn't appear until in whatever. So, and I didn't want to learn about the law, didn't want to learn about police procedure. So I needed a main character who was not a detective, not a policeman, and not a lawyer. And I wanted to create someone who was a complete egomaniacal idiot. And so, of course, an actor came to mind. And I just created this character called Will Power, who's an actor and a private inquiry agent, and he's hopeless at both.
And interestingly, Roland is an artist, not a detective.
The polar opposite of Will.
Well, the polar opposite, but he probably has a similar genesis in that I too am attracted to, I would call it efficiency as opposed to laziness.
Come on, Solari.
And so I avoided the forensic as well. I am a lawyer, but police procedures require a knowledge of procedure and police procedure as opposed to simply the law. So I wanted to avoid that as well. And the reason I picked that particular era is my husband is an historian, and his particular area of expertise is the extreme right-wing movements of New South Wales in the 1930s, which coincidentally is the background for the role.
Very handy.
Very, very handy.
Very efficient.
Yeah, very efficient.
Very efficient, you know, a researcher and an editor in one. And because I tell everybody that I used his research as the basis for the story, he's actually motivated to make sure I get nothing wrong. his name is attached to it. And so Roland came out of that. And in some ways, that era was a glorious surprise for me. I went into it very pragmatically. I needed Michael to keep editing for me, and I needed him to be therefore interested in what I was writing. So I wrote into his area of expertise to keep him basically tethered to my desk. And that was really my first experience of the 30s, actually picking up his history thesis and reading it. And as I became more and more involved in the era, I realized what a fantastically rich period that time between the wars was. And it's underwritten generally because it comes off the back of the very glamorous 20s and it's before the war. But people tend to skip the 1930s. But it was in the 1930s that brewed all the passions and the prejudices and the turbulence that led to World War II. And that's particularly what interests me as a writer.
And did you know when you started that you would spend so much time writing about that era? I mean, how many books are we up to now with Roland?
Book eight is finished, and I've just started book nine. I always knew when I started that this was going to be a long running series, because I could not get everything I needed to into one novel. So, you know, even when I started and thinking, you know, I'll write 1932, there just was so much material that I couldn't get 1932 into one novel. I had this idea when I started that I would write exactly that way, one novel for each year between 32 and 45. And now I'm up to novel nine, and I haven't got out in 1935 yet.
45? Stay out of my territory.
Ah. So the timelines are converging.
I was writing forward, but it would take me a while to catch up.
So that brings us to the convergence of these two stories. So there is a rumour that Roland Sinclair and William Powell will be appearing together soon.
That is not just a rumour, it's true.
So you're writing a play together.
We're co-writing a play. It was actually Solari's idea, and initially I thought, this is a seriously crap idea.
You didn't say that.
Now he's admitting it.
And then when I thought about it, I thought, no, this is a brilliant idea to take Solari's character, Roland, move him forward to 1939, take my character, Will, move him back from 42 to 39, and put them in the same place and have them meet, because they are such polar opposites that they won't get on at all. And it's a comedy, but it's also very serious, isn't it, Solari?
Yes. I mean, Robert and I have a vaguely similar style of writing in that we both like to find the absurdities in history and use them to actually contrast and highlight the patterns in history that we think people should recognise. And so that works really well when we're writing together. And that's been fairly seamless, hasn't it, Robert?
It has. It's been seamless and entertaining in an unseemly way.
So how are you actually doing it? Because you live in different states. Do you do it all by email? Do you catch up?
We met in December, wasn't it? Was it December or November?
November.
For a whole week. And just for that week, we met every day and we nutted out the entire armature of the play, scene by scene.
When Robert was in Batlow earlier this year, I think we wrote the plot in the back of a napkin.
Oh, we did, yes.
Literally.
In a coffee shop.
The play is set in Norman Lindsay's studio. Norman Lindsay is a character and someone is killing his models. And Roland and Will end up in the studio together by a series of mechanisms. And Norman Lindsay's a great character because he was such an awful man. An awful man.
And it's one of those things that's a really sad but telling contrast, in that he was a man of such art and wit and learning. And yet he was fundamentally a bigot. And that's one of the things that, you know, you like to explore as a writer.
Yeah. Mm. He had great hatreds, which he was proud of. He hated Jews. He hated Americans. He hated African Americans. He hated women. No matter what he said to the contrary, he thought women were half-formed creatures. That's an expression he uses. They have half minds. He hated homosexuals. Who else did he hate, Solari? Germans. With a passion, he hated Germans.
Everybody that wasn't Norman Lindsay.
Yeah.
Peril. He did some of that. He created some of that astonishing propaganda.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He was a strange mixture of everything that sounds typically National Socialist, but he hated Germans. So he could never be a Nazi. He could never enter into that field.
You know, this, I wonder whether his hatred of Germans came directly out of World War II and the loss of his brother. So it was a personal reason as opposed to...
World War One, you mean?
World War One, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
So generally, you know, had it not been for that, perhaps he would have leant much further towards the fascist cause than he ended up doing.
Possibly. He admired Nietzsche.
Yes.
But one of the things he admired most about Nietzsche was that Nietzsche hated Germans, other Germans.
So he's not a suspect in this murder.
Yes, he is.
Oh, he is.
He is a suspect.
Oh, right. Yeah. We can't do any spoilers.
No spoilers. So it is both a comedy, but also looking at the social world in 1939, just as the war is about to break. So there's stuff about communists and national socialists and anti-Semites.
And the interesting thing for us, with respect to this play, is writers have turned their books into stage plays before, and they've turned their books into screenplays before. That's not new. But I personally don't know of any attempt before to bring two completely separate books and completely separate characters into the one stage play.
It's sort of like a strange form of fan fiction, but written by the authors.
And perhaps, you know, with the entertainment we're getting writing it gives us an insight into why people write fan fiction.
Because it's great fun. It's great fun. So, yeah, we write a scene and we email it to each other. And if I've got a scene where Rowley appears, Solari will go over it and change because I can't get Rowley's voice.
So that's... And Will's voice is very uniquely Rob. So, you know, I know I was writing a scene last night and I almost sketch out his dialogue rather than write his dialogue, and then Robert goes into the full prose that is Will. But we had some interesting things to pull together because, you know, it was only once we started writing the play that we realised that as much as Will is verbose, Roland hardly ever says anything.
That's right. That's Roland true. Is a silent man.
That's true. And both series are they're both very funny, but in very different ways.
Exactly. Well, this Roland is much more about the quiet observation, while Will is full spotlight.
Noisy observation.
that's worked very well into the structure of the play. So because Robert writes in first person through Will, Will breaks the fourth wall and talks directly to the audience.
And explains what's going on.
Pushing Roland out of the spotlight.
Yes.
Exactly.
Will explains what's going on incorrectly.
Exactly. So, and Roland does a lot of observational eyebrow raising.
But Edna's there to do a lot of talking. She's quite chatty.
Bless her. We love Edna.
Yeah. I think we would have been strung up if we tried to leave Edna out of the play.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, when you're thinking about things like how many cast members you have, you can't bring Rowley's full entourage of bohemians and artists into it. So, whilst Will tends to be primarily a one-man band, Roland doesn't often travel, except for this play, without his full entourage of artists and sculptors and, you know, brothers and sister-in-law and so on. So we've had to do a little bit of chiseling back for that. It's worked well, and it's been a great deal of fun to write, and to actually get the stage play to match both canons, the Will Power series and the Roland Sinclair series, so that it sits comfortably in both.
I can imagine. And can we just talk maybe a little bit about the novels and your separate processes then? So I can imagine the text for the play will be very, very spare, not... mostly, of course, dialogue, whereas the books are a completely different creature altogether.
Yeah.
And both rich with historical detail.
Yeah, well, whenever Will speaks, it's not spare. It's gaudy.
It's gaudy, and both worlds are very rich, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
In the atmosphere and the detail and the politics and everything that's going on. So how much do you invent and how much is research-based?
Solari?
For me, I'm because I have Michael sitting like a hawk watching my historical detail, I use history as a scaffolding and I don't change it. So I'm fairly faithful to timelines and events, etc. And I because, you know, Roland didn't actually exist, and his, you know, closer companions didn't actually exist, I use their story to actually make things up. So I weave a story in through the historical scaffolding, keeping the historical events exactly in place, but perhaps taking a different perspective on them. And wherever there is a place in the narrative that can be filled by a real historical figure, I use a real historical figure rather than make one up.
So you have to fit your imagined characters into the life timelines of real people like Errol Flynn and Norman Lindsay.
Yeah, look, I was thinking about it this morning, actually. Part of it comes from the fact that my background is in the law. And one of the things you learn as a law, as a lawyer, is that the truth has many faces, and it just depends on the direction from which you're looking. So quite often, with any set of facts that are put in front of me, my natural instinct is to think of other ways in which that way that same set of facts or that same conclusion could have been reached with a different scenario. And quite often, that's how I fiddle things to actually make the historical story come out at the same time as having an entirely new set of facts feeding into it.
And my process is pretty much the same. The scaffolding, the historical scaffolding of the Will Power novels is very tight and true to time and place. And it's especially true of the other series I write, which are also set in the 1940s, which are a much darker, more serious series, set in Melbourne, in the Melbourne Homicide Department. And the historical scaffolding in that is very, very tight.
Well, one of the things that I do, and I think Robert probably does in relation to the people we use, is that we don't accuse them of doing things that are worse than the record shows. So if we are saying that Norman Lindsay is an anti-Semite, it's because the record shows that he was an anti-Semite. We're not making that up.
No.
And you know, that's not a legal requirement, because the law in Australia is that if someone's dead, you can say whatever you want about them. It's an ethical decision that writers make, and every writer chooses the line where they'll draw that, or chooses the place where they'll draw that line, rather, that they won't cross in relation to making things up if there are real people involved.
So one of the things, I guess, about writing about the near past is that you do have access to diaries and letters and literature, which tells you about the time. How do you use those sorts of resources? And how do you get to understand how people at that time felt?
This is the difficult thing. One of the things I wrestle with writing historical fiction, historical crime fiction, in the Holiday Murders and the Port Fairy Murders, I was looking at a very dark side of Australian society, which was the presence in Australia of proper hardcore National Socialists working within Melbourne and in Sydney, and particularly an organisation called Australia First, who were great admirers of Nazi Germany and Hitler, and they had a magazine called The Publicist, and I wanted to use material from that magazine to underpin certain moments in the novel. And I also wanted to use real newspaper accounts to underpin important sections of the novel. But because they're embedded in a piece of fiction, it's difficult for a reader to understand, oh, this bit's actually true, but it's embedded in a field of fiction. So, Lara, you do a similar thing too, don't you? You put newspaper reports at the beginning of each of your chapters, and they're not made
visibly,
up.
They're not made up, no.
They're real.
They're actually dug out. But part of the reason I did that, Robert, is that the first book, A Few Right Thinking Men, when I initially sent it out to publishers, it got a good reception, but I'd get these letters back, and particularly from Pantera, who are my publishers, when they were doing the first edit, they would say to me, look, we love the story, but you've really gone too far in this chapter. You know, that's insane.
Couldn't possibly happen in Australia.
And yeah, and the things that they thought that I had gone too far in terms of making things up were actual historical facts.
Yeah.
And so what the initially when I put in those little newspaper articles, it was to and you're not there to argue with the reader. So, you know, one of the things that is unfortunate about the whole writing process is whilst you are going into the reader's mind with your words, if you lose them, and you lose them unfairly because they think that you are that you have bent the truth too far in one part of the book, you're not there to argue with them to say, no, that actually happened. So those historical extracts or those newspaper extracts were there actually to say to them, hang on, this part is actually based on reality. And this is, you know, as unbelievable as it is, because quite often truth is stranger than fiction, that's actually what happened.
It is not fake news.
No, it's not fake news.
No. And, you know, look, it was one of the things that I found so interesting about this period and frightening and absolutely despairing as well, is that when I started on the whole journey of Roland Sinclair after I discovered the 1930s, what has always motivated me is I wanted to know how the world got to World War II, how the German people and the rest of the world got to a situation where we murdered so many people in concentration camps and did, you know, and allowed it to happen for years before the world knew and closed our eyes to what was going on. Because what you realize when you look at the newspaper extracts of the 1930s is that there were signs that this was building. It didn't happen all behind closed doors. And unfortunately, what's happening now is actually showing me how that can happen, how good people can just turn a blind eye, how good people can just get busy and not stand strong, how people can be distracted, how all of a sudden, you know, paying your mortgage becomes more important than the fact that, you know, we're building concentration camps. And that's been such a strange parallel and a strange journey for me. I think at the end of book one, in you know, the usual author blurbs, I was talking about the thing that I loved most about learning about that period was this notion that Australia could step up to the abyss and then step back. And I was confident that there was something special about Australians that would not go there. And I think that faith has been shaken a little bit as, you know, I continue to write and as the events in the era we're living in continue to unfold.
And do you think then that's why, that's the appeal of historical fiction? Do we read historical fiction to read about the past or to reflect upon the present, or perhaps both?
I think both.
Yes.
I mean, because the thing that connects us to all historical fiction is simply the humanity of the characters in historical fiction. We're all linked by who we are in all
exactly.
Our weaknesses and foibles. It's just us.
Yes. And, you know, there's central characters. I mean, one of the things that I love about Will is that though, you know, Robert will tell you that he's an egomaniac and is vaguely incompetent and finds himself in situations that are comic and ridiculous at the same time, in essence, he's a good man.
Yes, he doesn't have malice.
Yeah. And in essence, you know, some things I just give it. And for me, that's always been my criteria for humanity. If someone asked you for help, would you give it? And my criteria for separating good guys and the bad guys, you know, in any story. So historical fiction, what people latch onto is that beacon of humanity that sits in the centre of stories. So regardless of what is happening in the era around them, they use that beacon of humanity to guide them through. And I suppose the hope is with crime fiction is that if Will Power can make his way through, and if Roland Sinclair can make his way through being good men, then maybe them kind of can make our way through.
Oh, you're such a sentimentalist.
And it also, it tells me that I can see them working together on stage, because Roland is always trying to help people and Will is always in need of help.
That's true. Well, Will always has to solve the crimes because he's so incompetent. He always ends up being the main suspect.
Well, that's the problem with, you know, your amateur detectives. You've got to, the first hurdle that you have to jump with an amateur detective is you've got to link them to the crime somehow. Otherwise, you've got to give them a reason to investigate. And I can tell you that once you get to book 8, you're sort of getting a bit thin on different reasons to investigate.
That's the advantage of Will, you see.
Oh, you're up to book 4 now, aren't you?
I'm up to book 4 in Will and book 3 in the other
book 3
series.
There's another one coming. Fantastic.
Yeah, the sequel to the Port Fairy Murders is on the way.
That second series, the
yes.
Port, does that have a name?
Oh, I just call it the I just call it the Melbourne Homicide series.
The Melbourne Homicide series, that's yeah. Police procedural, so they have a reason.
Yeah,
to
they. I had to actually learn.
They are actually detectives
about police procedures. Yes,
at that time
in the 1940s, especially where women sat.
Yes.
In the police force.
Because that's
in
one
the
of the interesting dynamics
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Oh, look, the wonderful thing about the 30s and 40s, though, is even though it is in living memory, where people have this feeling of familiarity with regards to what went on in that period, the people who are still alive who directly remember that period are very, very old. And their memories are failing a little bit too. And so what I find is 90-year-olds will write to me and say, yes, that's exactly how it happened. You know, when I was a child, that's exactly how I remember it. But they're remembering something that happened 80 years ago. It's, you know, quite often I wonder how much of their memory is being assisted by the stuff I make up.
And everything they've read and seen in between and the stories
exactly.
they tell. Yeah. So, Robert, if you're a person without a historian in your house,
yes.
Where do you start with your research? Do you just Google a few things and off you go?
Google is wonderful, but there are newspapers particularly I have found useful, trawling through newspapers, which I love doing. Trove is a miracle. It is just a miracle.
And the National Library's...
And the fact that it's been defunded is just a scandal, an absolute scandal. But it is one of the world's great resources for newspapers in Australia. If people have never explored it, you just go online to Trove, and every newspaper in Australia, from the 19th century up to the 1960s, is online.
Yeah, so pretty much everything that's out of copyright.
Yep.
Including lots of small...
Small, local,
and it's
country
small
newspapers.
And the small ones that are brilliant.
They
like
are brilliant.
This Barrier Minor and tiny, tiny little newspapers, and they have the most amazing articles.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, and Truth. Absolute genius.
Actually, yes, because that's perfect for both of you.
Yeah. Well, the thing with historical fiction is that sometimes it's what people thought was true that's more... Of more use to a story than what was actually true. So it doesn't really matter whether it actually happened or not. If people thought it happened, that will influence how people behave in that era.
Yeah. And there are key texts for my second series. One of the key texts that I stumbled on, I wish I'd stumbled on it earlier, is a book by David Bird called The Nazi Dreamtime about Australian Nazis. And it is just the most rigorous academic study of that period, and it's a wonderful book. Anyone who's interested in that should go and get that book.
So, Solari, any favourite historical resources of yours besides your husband?
Andrew Moore, and in fact my husband introduced me to his book. So he wrote extensively on the right-wing movements or the extremist movements in Australia, New South Wales, and a little bit in Victoria as well, of that period, the 1930s. And he influenced me not just even in the way or in the actual facts that he wrote into his historical text, It's also with the attitude and the way he wrote about it. There was always this sense of absurdity and sense of the comic while he wrote it, or as he wrote it. So while you're reading it, it just sort of, it makes you smile as you're reading about riots and so on, because it seems to be so Australian, and the attitude seems to be so Australian. Of course, Michael Cathcart wrote Defending the National Tuck Shop, which is a brilliant book as well. And is it still in print, Rob?
I'm not sure. If it's not, it should be. It's such a great book.
Which is, yeah. And look, the other thing that I always tell people is I talk to people, and that's a wonderful resource. People have so much information locked in. Not necessarily about the era, though I have received a lot of information from older Australians who remember bits and pieces, or who remember stories from their parents that have been absolutely invaluable. We're not just writing about a historical period, we're writing about people. And quite often, just talking to people and listening to the way they tell stories, what they're drawn to, what matters to them, the inflections they use, the little quirks of language and personality all feed into research. I've always been fond of saying, you know, I've been writing for 7 years now, and all the time before that was collecting material. I didn't actually know I was collecting material, but I was.
What's interesting is that it is difficult to find out really basic things like how the telephone system worked in particular parts of Australia. Did people, when you picked up the phone, was it 100% of the time an operator that you spoke to? Those simple things are really difficult to find out. So that's where talking to someone is great. And what were bathrooms like? What was a stove like? That sort of stuff.
Yes. What do you use to light it? How difficult was it to light?
Yeah.
Not that Roland ever liked stoves.
No, it's beneath him. Will he has help
light,
for that.
Will doesn't light stoves either. What Rolly and Will have in common, Rolly is, I suppose, a Brahmin, and Will is very upper middle class. He was raised in a wealthy family as well. Yeah. So they've got a similar social attitude, but they're both, they're not in any way snobby.
No.
Will's an elitist, certainly, but he's not a social snob.
No. It's very much based on a personality with Will.
Yes, and perceptions of someone's particular gifts, rather than their social standing. He's not interested in social standing.
Well, and with Roland, it's very much on how interesting a person is.
Mm.
He doesn't even really care how bright they are and so on, but if someone is dull, that's what he's possibly most prejudiced against.
Although he's not overly keen on Errol Flynn, we have to admit.
Well, yes, but that may have something to do with Edna. Yeah, he is only human in that respect. And yes, I think that if you are trying to work your way into Roland's heart, making a play for Edna is not the greatest idea.
Well, we look forward to seeing how you two bring these two characters together on stage. And we also look forward to hearing you live at the conference in September. So thank you, Solari and Robert, for your time today.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
It's been wonderful.
Pleasure. Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Melbourne, from the 8th to the 10th of September, the conference will explore ideas around identity and writing in historical fiction. There'll be interviews, practical workshops, debates, and academic panels. You'll hear from the likes of Kerry Greenwood, Arnold Zabel, Kate Forsyth, and Melissa Ashley. And our podcast guests, including Deborah Challenor, Lucy Trelaw, Sophie Masson, Solari Gentile, and Robert Gott. And me, I'm Kelly Gardner. You can find out more or buy tickets online from hnsa.org.au.